Chapter 4. Term. Following a general election, a new parliamentary session begins. Parliament is formally summoned 40 days in advance by the Sovereign, who is the source of parliamentary authority. On the day indicated by the Sovereign's proclamation, the two Houses assemble in their respective chambers. The Commons are then summoned to the House of Lords, where Lords Commissioners, who are representatives of the Sovereign, instruct them to elect a Speaker. The Commons perform the election. On the next day, they return to the House of Lords, where the Lords Commissioners confirm the election, and grant the new Speaker the royal approval in the Sovereign's name. The business of Parliament for the next few days of its session involves the taking of the oaths of allegiance. Once a majority of the members has taken the oath in either House, the state opening of Parliament may occur. The Lords take their seats in the House of Lords chamber, the Commons appear at the bar immediately outside the chamber, and the Sovereign takes his or her seat on the throne. The Sovereign then reads the speech from the throne, the content of which is determined by the ministers of the Crown, outlining the government's legislative agenda for the upcoming year. Thereafter, each House proceeds to the transaction of legislative business. By custom, before considering the government's legislative agenda, a bill is introduced pro forma in each House, the Select Vestries Bill in the House of Lords and the Outlawries Bill in the House of Commons. These bills do not become laws. They are ceremonial indications of the power of each House to debate independently of the Crown. After the pro forma bill is introduced, each House debates the content of the speech from the throne for several days. Once each House formally sends its reply to the speech, legislative business may commence, appointing committees, electing officers, passing resolutions, and considering legislation. A session of Parliament is brought to an end by a proclamation. There is a ceremony similar to the state opening, but much less well known. Normally, the Sovereign does not personally attend the proclamation ceremony in the House of Lords. He or she is represented by the Lords Commissioners. The next session of Parliament begins under the procedures just described, but it is not necessary to conduct another election of a Speaker or take the oaths of allegiance afresh at the beginning of such subsequent sessions. Instead, the state opening of Parliament proceeds directly. To avoid the delay of opening a new session in the event of an emergency during a long summer recess, Parliament is no longer prorogued beforehand, but only after the Houses have reconvened in the autumn. The state opening follows a few days later. Each Parliament comes to an end, after a number of sessions, either by the command of the Sovereign or by affliction of time, the former being more common in modern times. The dissolution of Parliament is effected by the Sovereign, always on the advice of the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister may seek dissolution because the time is politically advantageous to his or her party. If the Prime Minister loses the support of the House of Commons, he must either resign or seek dissolution of Parliament to renew his or her mandate. Originally, there was no fixed limit on the length of a Parliament, but the Triennial Act 1694 set the maximum duration at 3 years. As the frequent elections were deemed inconvenient, the Septennial Act 1716 extended the maximum to 7 years, but the Parliament Act 1911 reduced it to 5. During the Second World War, the term was temporarily extended to 10 years by Acts of Parliament. Since the end of the war, the maximum has remained 5 years. Modern parliaments, however, rarely continue for the maximum duration. Normally, they are dissolved earlier. For instance, the 52nd, which assembled in 1997, was dissolved after 4 years. Formally, the demise of the Sovereign automatically brought a parliament to an end, the Crown being seen as the caput principium et finis, beginning, basis and end, of the body. But this is no longer the case. The first change was during the reign of William and Mary, when it was seen to be inconvenient to have no Parliament at a time when succession to the Crown could be disputed, and an Act was passed that provided that a Parliament was to continue 6 months after the death of a Sovereign, unless dissolved earlier. The Representation of the People Act 1867 brought this arrangement to an end. After each Parliament concludes, the Crown issues writs to hold a general election and elect new members of the House of Commons. membership of the House of Lords does not change due to dissolution. Each parliament that assembles following a general election is deemed to be distinct from the one which just concluded, and is separately numbered, the present parliament being the 54th parliament of the United Kingdom, since the formation of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland in 1801. Previous parliaments were of Great Britain, or of England, of Scotland, or of Ireland. Chapter 5. Legislative Functions. Laws can be made by Acts of the United Kingdom Parliament. While Acts can apply to the whole of the United Kingdom, including Scotland, due to the continuing separation of Scots law, many Acts do not apply to Scotland, and are either matched by equivalent Acts that apply to Scotland alone, or, since 1999, by legislation set by the Scottish Parliament relating to devolved matters. This has led to what is known as the West Lothian question, the situation where Westminster MPs for Scottish constituencies may vote on legislation that will have no direct effect on Scotland. Laws, in draft form known as bills, may be introduced by any member of either House, but usually the bill is introduced by a Minister of the Crown. A bill introduced by a Minister is known as a Government Bill. One introduced by another member is called a Private Member's Bill. A different way of categorising bills involves the subject. Most bills involving the general public are called public bills. A bill that seeks to grant special rights to an individual or a small group of individuals is called a private bill. A private bill which has broader public implications is called a hybrid bill. Private members' bills make up only about 1 in 8 of bills and are far less likely to be passed than government bills. There are 3 methods for an MP to introduce a private members' bill. The private members' ballots put names into a ballot, and those who win are given time to propose a bill. The 10-minute rule is another method, where MPs are granted 10 minutes to outline the case for a new piece of legislation. Standing Order 58 is the third method, which allows a bill to be introduced without debate if a day's notice is given to a speaker. Filibustering is a danger, as an opponent to a bill can waste much of the limited time allotted to it. Private members' bills have no chance of success if the current government opposes them, but they are used in moral issues. The bills to decriminalise homosexuality and abortion were private members' bills, for example. Governments can sometimes attempt to use private members' bills to pass things it would rather not be associated with. Handout bills are when a government hands proposed bills to MPs who win private members' ballots. Each bill goes through several stages in each House. The first stage, called the first reading, is a formality. At the second reading, the general principles of the bill are debated, and the House may vote to reject the bill by not passing the motion that the bill be now read a second time. Defeats of government bills are extremely rare, the last being in 2005. Following the second reading, the bill is sent to a committee. In the House of Lords, the Committee of the Whole House, or the Grand Committee, are used. Each consists of all members of the House. The latter operates under special procedures, and is used only for uncontroversial bills. In the House of Commons, the bill is usually committed to a standing committee, consisting of between 16 and 50 members, but the Committee of the Whole House is used for important legislation. Several other types of committees, including select committees, may be used, but rarely. A committee considers the bill clause by clause, and reports its proposed amendments to the entire House, where further detailed consideration occurs. However, the kangaroo, Standing Order 31, allows the Speaker to select which amendments are debated. This device is commonly used under Standing Order 89 by the Committee Chairman on behalf of the Government to restrict debate in committee. Once the House has considered the bill, the third reading continues. In the House of Commons, no further amendments may be made, and the passage of the motion that the bill be now read a third time is passage of the whole bill. In the House of Lords, further amendments to the bill may be moved. After the passage of the third reading motion, the House of Lords must vote on the motion that the bill do now pass. Following its passage in one House, the bill is sent to the other House. If passed in identical form by both Houses, it may be presented for the Sovereign's assent. If one House passes amendments that the other will not agree to, and the two Houses cannot resolve their disagreements, the bill fails. However, since the passage of the Parliament Act 1911, the power of the House of Lords to reject bills passed by the House of Commons has been restricted, and further restrictions were placed by the Parliament Act 1949. If the House of Commons passes a public bill in two successive sessions, and the House of Lords rejects it both times, the Commons may direct that the bill be presented to the Sovereign for his or her assent, disregarding the rejection of the bill in the House of Lords. In each case, the bill must be passed by the House of Commons at least one calendar month before the end of the session. The provision does not apply to bills originated in the House of Lords, to bills seeking to extend the duration of a Parliament beyond 5 years, or to private bills. A special procedure applies in relation to bills classified by the Speaker of the House of Commons as money bills. A money bill concerns solely national taxation or public funds. The Speaker's certificate is deemed conclusive under all circumstances. If the House of Lords fails to pass a money bill within 1 month of its passage in the House of Commons, the lower house may direct that the bill be submitted for the Sovereign's assent immediately. Even before the passage of the Parliament Acts, the Commons possessed preeminence in cases of financial matters. By ancient custom, the House of Lords may not introduce a bill relating to taxation or supply, nor amend a bill so as to insert a provision relating to taxation or supply, nor amend a supply bill in any way. The House of Commons is free to waive this privilege, and sometimes does so to allow the House of Lords to pass amendments with financial implications. The House of Lords remains free to reject bills relating to supply and taxation, but may be overruled easily if the bills are money bills. A bill relating to revenue and supply may not be a money bill if, for example, it includes subjects other than national taxation and public funds. The last stage of a bill involves the granting of the royal assent. Theoretically, the Sovereign may either grant the royal assent, that is, make the bill a law, or withhold it, that is, veto the bill. Under modern conventions, the Sovereign always grants the royal assent, in the Norman French words, la reine le veut, the Queen wishes it. The last refusal to grant the assent was in 1708, when Queen Anne withheld her assent from a bill for the settling of militia in Scotland. In the words, la reine s'avisera, the Queen will think it over. Thus, every bill obtains the assent of all three components of Parliament before it becomes law, except where the House of Lords is overridden under the Parliament Acts. The words, be it enacted by the Queen's/King's Most Excellent Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Lords Spiritual and Temporal, and Commons, in this present Parliament assembled, and by the authority of the same, as follows. Or, where the House of Lords' authority has been overridden by use of the Parliament Acts, the words, be it enacted by the Queen's/King's Most Excellent Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Commons, in this present Parliament assembled, in accordance with the provisions of the Parliament Acts 1911 and 1949, and by the authority of the same, as follows, appear near the beginning of each Act of Parliament. These words are known as the enacting formula. Chapter 6. Judicial Functions. In addition to its legislative functions, Parliament also performs several judicial functions. The Queen in Parliament constitutes the highest court in the realm for most purposes, but the Privy Council has jurisdiction in some cases, for instance, appeals from ecclesiastical courts. The jurisdiction of Parliament arises from the ancient custom of petitioning the Houses to redress grievances and do justice. The House of Commons ceased considering petitions to reverse the judgment of lower courts in 1399, effectively leaving the House of Lords as the court of last resort. In modern times, the judicial functions of the House of Lords are performed not by the whole House, but by a group of Lords of Appeal in Ordinary, who are judges granted life peerage dignities under the Appellate Jurisdiction Act 1876 by the Sovereign, and by Lords of Appeal, who are other peers with experience in the judiciary. The Lords of Appeal in Ordinary and Lords of Appeal, or Law Lords, are members of the House of Lords, but normally do not vote or speak on political matters. In the late 19th century, Acts allowed for the appointment of Scottish Lords of Appeal in Ordinary and ended appeal in Scottish criminal matters to the House of Lords, so that the High Court of Justiciary became the highest criminal court in Scotland. Nowadays, the House of Lords Legislative Committee usually has a minimum of 2 Scottish judges to ensure that some experience of Scots law is brought to bear on Scottish appeals in civil cases from the Court of Session. Certain other judicial functions have historically been performed by the House of Lords. Until 1948, it was the body in which peers had to be tried for felonies or high treason. Now, they are tried by normal juries. When the House of Commons impeaches an individual, the trial takes place in the House of Lords. Impeachments are now rare. The last one occurred in 1806. As of 2006, a number of MPs are trying to revive the custom, who have signed a motion for the impeachment of Tony Blair, but this is unlikely to succeed. Chapter 7. Relationship with the Government. The British government is answerable to the House of Commons. However, neither the Prime Minister nor members of the government are elected by the House of Commons. Instead, the Queen requests the person most likely to command the support of a majority in the House, normally the leader of the largest party in the House of Commons, to form a government. So that they may be accountable to the lower house, the Prime Minister and most members of the Cabinet are members of the House of Commons. The last Prime Minister to be a member of the House of Lords was Alec Douglas Hume, 14th Earl of Hume, who became Prime Minister in 1963. To adhere to the convention under which he was responsible to the lower house, he disclaimed his peerage and procured election to the House of Commons within days of becoming Prime Minister. Governments have a tendency to dominate the legislative functions of Parliament by using their inbuilt majority in the House of Commons and sometimes using their patronage power to appoint supportive peers in the Lords. In practice, governments can pass any legislation, within reason, in the Commons they wish, unless there is major dissent by MPs in the governing party. But even in these situations, it is highly unlikely a bill will be defeated, though dissenting MPs may be able to extract concessions from the government. In 1976, Lord Hailsham created a now widely used name for this behaviour in an academic paper called Elective Dictatorship. Parliament controls the executive by passing or rejecting its bills and by forcing ministers of the Crown to answer for their actions, either at question time or during meetings of the parliamentary committees. In both cases, ministers are asked questions by members of their houses and are obliged to answer. Although the House of Lords may scrutinise the executive through question time and through its committees, it cannot bring down the government. A ministry must always retain the confidence and support of the House of Commons. The lower house may indicate its lack of support by rejecting a motion of confidence or by passing a motion of no confidence. Confidence motions are generally originated by the government in order to reinforce its support in the House, whilst no confidence motions are introduced by the opposition. The motions sometimes take the form that this House has no confidence or has confidence in Her Majesty's government, but several other varieties, many referring to specific policies supported or opposed by Parliament, are used. For instance, a confidence motion of 1992 used the form that this House expresses the support for the economic policy of Her Majesty's government. Such a motion may theoretically be introduced in the House of Lords, but as the government need not enjoy the confidence of that House, would not be of the same effect as a similar motion in the House of Commons. The only modern instance of such an occurrence involves the no confidence motion that was introduced in 1993 and subsequently defeated. Many votes are considered votes of confidence, although not including the language mentioned above. Important bills that form part of the government's agenda, as stated in the Speech from the Throne, are generally considered matters of confidence. The defeat of such a bill by the House of Commons indicates that a government no longer has the confidence of that House. The same effect is achieved if the House of Commons withdraws supply, that is, rejects the budget. Where a government has lost the confidence of the House of Commons, the Prime Minister is obliged either to resign or to seek the dissolution of Parliament and a new general election. Where a Prime Minister has ceased to retain a majority in that vote and requests a dissolution, the Sovereign can in theory reject his request, forcing his resignation and allowing the Leader of the Opposition to be asked to form a new government. This power is used extremely rarely. The conditions that should be met to allow such refusal are known as the Lascelles Principles. These conditions and principles are merely informal conventions. It is possible, though highly improbable, for the Sovereign to refuse dissolution for no reason at all. In practice, the House of Commons' scrutiny of the government is very weak. Since the first-past-the-post electoral system is employed in elections, the governing party tends to enjoy a large majority in the Commons. There is often limited need to compromise with other parties. Modern British political parties are so tightly organised that they leave relatively little room for free action by their MPs. In many cases, MPs may be expelled from their parties for voting against the instructions of party leaders. During the 20th century, the government has lost confidence issues only three times, twice in 1924 and once in 1979. Chapter 8. Sovereignty. Several different views have been taken of Parliament's sovereignty. According to the jurist Sir William Blackstone, it has sovereign and uncontrollable authority in making, confirming, enlarging, restraining, abrogating, repealing, reviving, and expounding of laws concerning matters of all possible denominations, ecclesiastical or temporal, civil, military, maritime or criminal. It can, in short, do everything that is not naturally impossible. A different view has been taken by the Scottish judge Lord Cooper of Culross. When he decided the 1953 case of McCormick v. Lord Advocate as Lord President of the Court of Session, he stated, "The principle of unlimited sovereignty of Parliament is a distinctively English principle and has no counterpart in Scottish constitutional law." He continued, "Considering that the Union legislation extinguished the Parliaments of Scotland and England and replaced them by a new Parliament, I have difficulty in seeing why the new Parliament of Great Britain must inherit all the peculiar characteristics of the English Parliament, but none of the Scottish." Nevertheless, he did not give a conclusive opinion on the subject. Thus, the question of parliamentary sovereignty appears to remain unresolved. Parliament has not passed any act defining its own sovereignty. Parliament's power has often been eroded by its own acts. Acts passed in 1921 and 1925 granted the Church of Scotland complete independence in ecclesiastical matters. More recently, its power has been restricted by membership of the European Union, which has the power to make laws enforceable in each member state. In the Factor Tuomi case, the European Court of Justice ruled that UK courts could have powers to overturn UK legislation contravening EU law. Parliament has also created national devolved assemblies with legislative authority in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Parliament still has the power over areas for which responsibility lies with the devolved institutions, but would usually ask permission of those institutions to act on its behalf. Similarly, it has granted the power to make regulations to ministers of the Crown, and the power to enact religious legislation to the General Synod of the Church of England. Measures of the General Synod and, in some cases, proposed statutory instruments made by ministers must be approved by both houses before they become law. In every case aforementioned, authority has been conceded by Act of Parliament and may be taken back in the same manner. It is entirely within the authority of Parliament, for example, to abolish the devolved government in Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland, or to leave the EU. However, Parliament also revoked its legislative competence over the Commonwealth of Australia with the Australia Act. Although the UK could pass an act reversing its action, it would not take effect in Australia, as the competence of the Imperial Parliament is no longer recognised in law. One well-recognised exception to Parliament's power involves binding future Parliaments. No Act of Parliament may be made secure from amendment or repeal by a future Parliament. For example, although the Act of Union 1800 states that the kingdoms of Great Britain and Ireland are to be united forever, Parliament permitted Southern Ireland to leave the United Kingdom in 1922. Chapter 9. Privileges. Each House of Parliament possesses and guards various ancient privileges. The House of Lords relies on inherent right. In the case of the House of Commons, the Speaker goes to the Lord Chamber at the beginning of each new Parliament and requests representatives of the Sovereign to confirm the lower House's undoubted privileges and rights. The ceremony observed by the House of Commons dates to the reign of King Henry VIII. Each House is the guardian of its privileges, and may punish breaches thereof. The extent of parliamentary privilege is based on law and custom. Sir William Blackstone states that these privileges are, quote, very large and indefinite, end quote, and cannot be defined except by the Houses of Parliament themselves. The foremost privilege claimed by both Houses is that of freedom of speech in debate. Nothing said in either House may be questioned in any court or other institution outside Parliament. Another privilege is that of freedom from arrest, except for high treason, felony, or breach of the peace. It applies during a session of Parliament and 40 days before or after such a session. Members of both Houses are also privileged from service on juries. Both Houses possess the power to punish breaches of their privilege. Contempt of Parliament, for example, disobedience of a subpoena issued by a committee, may also be punished. The House of Lords may imprison an individual for any fixed period of time, but an individual imprisoned by the House of Commons is set free upon prorogation. The punishments imposed by either House may not be challenged in any court. This is the end of the article. This sound file and all the text in the article are licensed under the GNU Documentation License, available at www.gnu.org/copyleft/ftl.html.